I don't want the act of shoemaking being the attempt to replicate and perfect something that a machine can do. That's not the point for me. I make handmade shoes. They are very, very, very handmade shoes. In order to do that and not have them be the art of bad shoemaking, I had to learn how to make shoes really, really seriously.
ShoeCast! Welcome to the Stitchdown ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things we love about it. I'm Ben from Stitchdown.com, and today I'm chatting with Sebastian Tarek, bespoke shoemaker in London's famed West End. Sebastian and I met last year at the Shoegazing Shoe Snob Super Trunk Show in London, then had a bunch of pints afterward, at which point I asked him to come on the show, and he said, in Australian, "Oh yeah, mate, let's get it. It'll be a real rip snorter. Ace." Or, something to that effect. And so, almost a year and some essential workshop Wi-Fi upgrades later, here we are. In addition to creating his own fantastic commissioned work and the occasional ready-to-wear collection, Sebastian has worked for years as a West End outworker, operating behind the scenes of London's major bespoke shops. We're going to get deep into that whole world, backtrack all the way through 18 generations of family shoemaking lineage, and explore Sebastian's unique construction and design sensibilities that result in some absolutely wonderful, kind of trapped-in-time shoes and boots. Before we get rolling, I just need to give a massive shout-out to our sponsor this week, Grant Stone. It's basically impossible to find a better value in Goodyear Welt footwear. Dozens upon dozens of styles come in widths up to triple E to fit almost every foot. Give the whole lineup a look at GrantStoneShoes.com. And if you're enjoying this ShoeCast, it would mean just everything if you wanted to support it by becoming part of the Stitchdown Premium community and its beating heart, the SDP Discord server. We're coming up on a couple thousand people chatting all day and night about shoes and boots and leather and lasts and MTOs and sizing, of course, and plenty, plenty more in the most engaging way imaginable. It's not weird. Actually, it's kind of weird. But like the really good kind of weird. You'll love it. Get all the details at stitchdown.com. Also, be sure to save the date for October 12th and 13th, 2024, for Stitchdown's Bootcamp 2, a two-day celebration of shoemaking and community gathering in Brooklyn, New York, with dozens of brands and tanneries and more from quite literally around the world, endless hands-on, educational shoemaking opportunities, industry panels, the whole deal. Seriously, wherever you live, get yourself to New York in October. You will not regret it. All right, let's bring him in. Sebastian Tarek. Welcome to the ShoeCast. How's everything?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm excited to do this. It's been a little bit of forever.
Yeah, this feels like it's been a long time in the making for sure.
All right, what are you wearing on your feet specifically?
Today, at your insistence, I'm wearing a pair of low-cut mock-toe shoes. I did a little non-bespoke project at the start of lockdown for my stockist over in Japan and wanted me to kind of like take the idea of something a little bit like a Red Wing set of boots and kind of like do a made-to-order thing so that we could continue to work remotely. And I always wanted a low-cut version of it. So today I am wearing the low-cut mock-toe setter shoe as done for my stockist in Tokyo.
Those things are great. What kind of soles are on them again?
Dr. Stoll Sportster, I think it's called.
They look great. All right. So we met like, I guess a little less than a year ago. And I was familiar with your work, followed you on Instagram as people do, read a whole bunch of stuff about you. And so when we met at the Shoegazing Super Trunk Show, where you were a judge for the World Championships in Shoemaking, I was kind of nervous, intimidated. Like, one, you got a better beard than me. Two, you make fantastic shoes. Generally, shoemakers, bespoke shoemakers are like cooler than you think that they might be and less pretentious. But I wasn't sure about you. I kind of presumed the worst. And then we went to the pub afterwards, kind of got after it a little bit. And then I bugged you for like almost a year to do this. So now here we are. We could talk about the pub too, but those championships, like how'd you get involved in that with Jesper and Dom and whoever? What was that whole thing like? Because it was pretty cool. I had always seen the pictures, but I'd never actually been there to see, in this case, all the boots that were made, and they're fucking wonderful.
Yeah, you got a good year to come down, actually. I think in terms of sort of like the specifics of what seems to be your particular interest, that was definitely the year to come down for it. In terms of my involvement, like I was an attendee from the very beginning. I'm pretty passionate about the community. I'm pretty committed to how the industry as a whole figures out ways of continuing to move forward. And a big enthusiast of what Jesper and Justin and all the other guys involved in putting that event on were doing. So to be honest, when Jesper asked me to be one of the judges, I was flattered and, to be frank, confused. He's asked me to do it 3 years running, and I'm always a bit like, are you sure you want me to judge? I feel a little bit like a phony at this, you know, like this is like an event for, you know, the cognoscenti of the industry. So I kind of like got over that enough. I convinced myself that basically he just wants a loudmouth there and that I'm a requisite loudmouth in that kind of audience. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's an opportunity to see people doing stuff you kind of have a fairly meaningful grasp of, but like absolutely pushing it to the nth degree. It feels both kind of like very modern because it's stylistically what they're working on is ways of interpreting, you know, kind of like classical styles, but like doing it from a perspective of what's influencing people today. But also it feels very historical, you know, like the reference point, I think, for the whole competition side of that event is once upon a time, there used to be these regular shoemaking competitions and people made a specific thing called competition shoes. I actually went up to the Northampton Shoe Museum archive probably a few weeks before the last Supertrunk and saw a small section of some of the stuff that they had there. And the lady who's the archivist there, Rebecca, she actually brought out a small selection of competition shoes, and they're just bonkers. No concern about the wearability of it. It's just how do you really flex the skills and craftsmanship involved.
How far back do those old competitions date? Like, when were they doing them?
Of the stuff that I saw when I was there, I think the oldest pair I saw was maybe mid-1850s.
No way.
I think they said they've got a little bit of older stuff. I think it's one of those things that sort of, like, became really popular when you had those big global craft trade things like World Trades Center fairs and stuff like that. And I think, you know, they were, like, part of a bigger kind of ecology. But that was the point where, you know, it was like it was really global. They weren't just kind of like local versions of it. So, yeah, I think mid-1850s, like roughly speaking, Industrial Revolution.
Damn. Bring it back, Jesper and Justin. Wait, so how do you like judge that, right? Because everything is, you know, here's the competition, right? It was like a black Balmoral boot, basically. And then people took it in every possible direction. I'm sure there's technical aspects to it and creative aspects, like, I mean, how does it work? You guys have like a checklist? Like how much of it is just like gut reaction, like a visceral feeling that they give you? Because they were all just exceptional. And like you'd never seen anything like any of them ever.
Yeah, I mean, like there's a specific criteria, and I'm definitely not telling tales out of school by talking about it because I think it's listed on the competition spec on the shoegazing website. There are 10 points for execution. 10 points for difficulty, as in like how challenging what you're trying to achieve was, and 5 points for design. Essentially, you have every one of the boots that there has a number underneath it. You have no idea who they are, and you just blind go through and look through every single boot, give your individual scores for those criteria, and then there's a number at the end of it. And you hand back your sheet, and it's only once all of the sheets are handed back that Jesper reads out whose boots are whose.
They're like there to be marveled at, and that part's really fun. And then the idea that you have to actually go and like pick them apart a little bit. I don't know. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting because like there's always a panel of about half a dozen people. And there's no doubt that certain people bring a certain attention to specific detail when they're there. So like when everybody's like poring over the upper of something, it's like, is that hand stitched? Like if somebody made an entire Balmoral boot where they've hand stitched the upper on the whole thing, there's one or two people you'll always defer to the judgment on that. And then it's like, because also the thing is we talk about it as we're doing it. Like, you know, you're not necessarily kind of like talking about sort of like how you're scoring it, but we're all having a conversation. Like it's in a small room, you know, we're all kind of like leaning over each other to kind of grab stuff. So you're having a conversation all the way through about sort of like specific details, you know, like asking each other questions, stuff like that. So, you know, you're picking it up. Part, but in the nicest part. It's pretty rare to hear somebody go, oof, that is janky. No. Like usually it's very focused. It's like, how could they have done that? And like the winning boot is the perfect example of that. Because we all like we're looking, it's like that's a really, really nice, clean looking boot, and then you flipped it over and you were like, oh, how the hell has he done that? They, whoever it was, you know, like you don't even know at that point. So that kind of thing, you know, all of a sudden it drags us all in and you're like,
I like that everybody's kind of like on top of each other discussing it all, right?
Oxygen can be in short supply pretty quickly.
Oh, there's opinions? Feelings? No. All right, well, you make shoes too and boots and all of it. Some really fantastic stuff that just like hits home with me, and we'll get to what you make previously now later. But your story, like how did you get started in this? And like, I mean, your family shoemaking history, like am I right that it stretches back 18 generations? How much of that is just clever marketing?
No, that really depends on which day of the week you ask my grandmother the story. Like it veered between 14 and 18 generations. One thing I can say categorically is it skipped three generations. So when I first started learning, I had no idea.
Oh, so you kind of picked up the lineage again.
My immediate family on that side are like people that use their brains, not their hands. And when I started studying shoemaking in my last year of high school, because basically I was bombing out of high school, like I'd had this really strong idea of what I wanted to do all the way through my schooling, and then had like a complete sort of like change of heart about that. I was actually over here on a sports tour from Australia watching crappy Christmas Day television, and there was this insanely camp musical with Danny Kaye in it, which was this fictionalized version of the story of Hans Christian Andersen. And I just thought, that looks like a nice life, roaming the countryside, telling stories, making shoes. So I decided to go back to Australia and I enrolled in what's called a TAFE course, which is sort of like a technical college kind of thing. It's like a lot of vocational courses and stuff like that. And while I desperately tried to finish high school, I did one evening a week of study on shoemaking. And I was halfway through my first year of that, that my grandmother said to me, you know, your great-great-grandfather will be so proud of you now that you're learning how to make shoes. And I was like, he was fond of shoes, Granny? She was like, no, he was a shoemaker. And that's where I found out from like maybe anything between, I think she said like mid-1500s. From that onwards, continuous, yeah.
How much do you know about that or just the granny story?
Very little. The next time I spoke to my grandmother about it several years later, and my grandmother looked like Yoda. She was a small Jewish lady. And she said, you know, I have this thing called Google Maps. You can look at the place where the workshop was. And one of the last things I did with her before she passed away was we went back to Poland. She knew the location. It was on the Żyroki Dunaj, I think it's called. When we got there, it turns out it's the cord-waning precinct of the old part of Warsaw. So we walked down this little cobblestone street, and like on every side, there are kind of like frescoes on the top of the building with these depictions of cobblers and shoemakers, and there were plaques, and there was a little kind of like cordwainer's museum. And she said, you know, I think at the end of the street, that's where your great-grandfather's workshop was.
Man, this one's a little unclear too, but I kind of realized through my mom, through her mom, that my great-great-grandfather was like a tanner.
Oh, no way.
The Midwest, and died at like 32 because of it. So yeah, you know, sometimes you figure this stuff out once you start doing something.
The relationship between tanning and society, particularly in this city, is just like fascinating. Like, you know, like obviously the UK has, you know, a pretty entrenched hierarchical class system, if you like, but you're never really particularly aware of like what's the lowest of the low. But consistently through history, you hear about people just being so casual, but like, oh, tanners, no. Like they were banned from the city of London, I think, in the early 1800s. But that's why like the last tannery in London was in Bermondsey, because it was just on the other side of the river. And it was basically considered to be like just the most decrepit thing you could do with your life.
Like because of, especially back then, kind of how gross it was. Yeah.
Gross. And I think how much it shortened your lifespan.
Yeah.
I think everything that's involved, even before we had sort of like commercial chemicals, there was a certain amount of like working with chemical reactions in order to do the tanning process. But I think it's going to end your life quick. And I think it's hard work.
Yeah, that's a story in my family. People should have been thanking them instead of being like, okay, thank you for this. Apparently I want this stuff. You're going to die at 32. And we appreciate your work. Please go do it somewhere else because you smell, maybe. But like to make them untouchables, it's kind of rough.
That's it, literally, though. It's untouchables. I mean, like, have you ever been to any of those, like, really, really rustic tanneries somewhere in North Africa? It's so bad. Like, if you go to a tannery in Morocco, like, in Fez, there's a famous tannery that everyone goes to. It's so famous that now the Moroccan Tourism Board has a guy from the Tourist Association out the front handing tourists a bunch of mint. And you're like, what do I need this for? They're like, put it under your nose.
Just tape it there. Oh, God. Well, glad we're both still kicking, staying away from, you know, 17th century tanneries. Okay, so you figure out all this stuff, lineage, generational, whatever. Does that matter? Like, are you still kind of deciding if this is actually what you're going to do with your life? And that you're like, oh, I guess I have to now. Or did that relate? Or were you just on your path and you were going to do this?
So, like, I started studying in 1995. I've continuously made shoes the entire time since then. But that's not to say that I worked as a shoemaker for that whole time by any stretch of imagination. So, like, I did a couple of years of study. I moved over here because I found out about Cordwainers College in Hackney, and I resolved that I was going to come here and study. But in order to do that, and even though I have a British passport because my mother's from North London, I had to get my residency. So that's a 3-year period. And being a guy in his late teens, I worked in bars. I maybe got a little bit distracted from my studies because it was late 90s, not London, and there was nowhere else in the world you wanted to be. But I kept studying. And then I went back to Australia for a trip, realized that actually I wanted to move back there. And I got myself a really good bar job that kind of meant that I didn't have to work all of God's hours. And I decided that because I had a little bit of spare time, I was going to try and find a shoemaker to do some work with, to kind of like see if I could get like an apprenticeship or something like that. And I ended up working for a guy named Andrew McDonald in Paddington in Sydney for a couple of years. I think once you go from study to actually working, you either have an epiphany or you just, you know, it's not for you. And I absolutely had the epiphany. Like going from like several years of, not just, I mean, it's not like that it's a particularly theoretical act of study, but, you know, you're always sort of like piecing together these different like little bits of modules of the course. And maybe you make a pair of shoes, but you don't really understand it very much. To actually being in an environment where someone's a bit like, you need to work faster and you need to stop scratching the uppers there. And all of a sudden, you know, it goes from the abstract to the concrete. So after doing that for a couple of years, I went and worked for the opera company in Australia for a season, making, you know, opera singers bespoke shoes, which is an incredibly thankless task. By the end of that period, I was like, okay, this is something serious. I really, 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 really want to pursue this. I'd done a couple of collections for designers in Australia for Fashion Week. And I decided that if I wanted to be, if this was going to be like what I did, like in a really serious fashion, as best possible as I could, I needed to come back to England, do a little bit more time, trying to like, you know, refine my skills a little bit more, develop some stuff. And then I was going to move back to Australia and have a wonderful life, live by the beach. You know, I had family that worked in fashion, so I felt like I had a good in to kind of like potentially set up a productive business. And when I came over here, I probably planned to be here for a year or two. And I think within like the first 18 months, it was like, I'm never going back to Australia. I was really lucky. I went and saw some people and kind of got laughed at with sort of like what I was proposing in terms of like, I want to work for free and then, you know, go back to Australia and start my own business. And some people were a bit like, get out of here. But my father had a friend over here who was a writer and she was interviewing one of the shoemakers I was really interested in. So she said, why don't I meet you for a cup of coffee after the interview? And if I could drop into conversation that I know somebody would like to meet you, I will to the shoe designer. So I did that. And her name was Georgina Goodman. She was a couture shoemaker and shoe designer who ended up designing most of Alexander McQueen's most iconic footwear. And she was sort of like, her business was still fairly nascent. She'd maybe had like a year of doing just couture shoes, which were beautiful and interesting and really pushing kind of the boundaries of how craft and design could kind of work together. And I ended up working for her for about a year. Through that, I met a guy named Dominic Casey, who many of your listeners and viewers will maybe know of. He'd been her teacher at the Royal College of Art. And he was there basically one day a week, kind of like just the kind of technical consultation. And Dom's just the nicest man in the world. Like, you know, like I don't think you'll ever find anyone that'll say a harsh word about him. He suggested that I go to James Taylor & Son because he thought they maybe had a little bit of work going. he knew that, you know, that they were probably one of the last firms that still kind of like had a bit of a notion of the importance of investing into sort of like fairly raw kind of like talent, if you like, and helping them go through the sort of like the process, if not quite in the way that it was done back in the day, but still to a certain degree. So I went and worked there, worked in a house for about 3.5 years. I did a range of different jobs. And ultimately, as was the tradition, at some point, the boss, Mr. Schweiger, says to you, you know, is there one aspect of this that you feel like you have a real passion for, as in like the different parts of the segments of shoemaking in the UK? And I said, you know, I think I really want to get into making welted footwear. He's like, okay, cool. I'll send you down to Dom for a little while and he can teach you, as somebody at James Taylor & Son did for Dom some 30 years previously. And that was the beginning of me being a specialist, what they call bottom maker over here. So after I'd done that I probably stayed there for about another year. Then I became a piece worker doing that job. And, you know, ever since then, I've worked as a bottom maker for a variety of firms, as well as starting my own business about 12 years ago. And in my own business, I do the whole thing. I was really confused when I had a meeting when I first moved back over here, and the guy was like, what do you want to do? What do you want to, are you going to be a closer or a clicker or a bottom maker? And I was like, I want to be a shoemaker. What are you asking me these stupid questions for? He's like, it's not really like that. You do one or the other. And I was like, what? A shoemaker's a shoemaker, isn't he? Throughout my whole process of going through these deliberational stages of what are you going to do, I've always wanted to make shoes from start to finish. So that's how I work on the stuff I do myself. And I still work as an outworker for one of the old firms.
So I promise we're going to get to your stuff. I promise. Right? This is Sebastian Tarek, start to finish shoes. But let's dig into this whole outworker thing a little bit, because I don't think everybody necessarily understands how it works. So let's say I'm a customer, right? I go into one of these kind of remaining houses, used to be dozens, maybe hundreds back in like late 1800s, early 1900s. But, you know, there's like a few now left, and you go in and it looks the part and they say, I want a pair of bespoke shoes. Please measure me. What happens after that? Obviously, you kind of come in towards the end, but, you know, I feel like there's a lot happening behind the scenes that like even the people purchasing these shoes might not necessarily understand.
I mean, to be frank, like even somebody that was making shoes at that point, when I first went in, it was both a mystery and, to be honest, like a bit of a shock when I realized to what degree the tasks are isolated, so like siloed into specialisms. So generally speaking, with one of the classical firms, I think you maybe have to think of the contemporary independents a little bit differently, people who don't necessarily have a bricks and mortar facility like a shopfront. But these old firms, you go in, you agree you want to have a pair of shoes made. Somebody will measure your feet. 9 times out of 10, that'll be the last maker.
That's good.
Classically speaking, you wouldn't make a last of somebody else's drafts. That's maybe a slightly outdated sort of like principle. There's no doubt there's a lot of people that would argue it's an essential, and doing anything else is leading yourself onto the path of ruin. But someone will measure your feet. Then somebody will make a last. Last making is generally in-house. Last manufacturers, that's a different thing. And obviously, Springline have a bespoke division where, you know, somebody takes the drafts and then they send them up to Michael and he makes a bespoke last. So that exists like outside of the kind of like bigger houses. So last gets made, a pattern will get made more often than not, again, in-house. And then the clicking will probably be the last thing which is done in-house. And it might be somebody who does another job as well as the clicking. And the clicking obviously is like the cutting out the pieces of leather that go together to make the upper. So once that's done, and maybe it's an interesting point, within the West End firms, traditionally you've rough clicked. So before you send the upper pieces to the closer, the person that's going to stitch them all together, you put the pattern pieces down, and rather than cutting out like close to the edge, you would put like a broad margin all the way around, because the assumption was that the closer needed to have like that final act of positioning so that they did the final click and then fitted them together. Quite often what you'd find is that the closer would be sent the upper rough clipped. They'd be sent a bunch of lining leather, and they'd be sent the working standard of the pattern. And it was their responsibility to make the lining pattern. And that's one of the reasons why you left all this kind of like excess space, is so that the closer really had a little bit of room to maneuver to kind of like get the best possible outcome. Then you have a finished upper that gets sent back to the firm, quite often pinned on the last. And then that gets sent out to a bottom maker. That's not universal. There are definitely firms that have bottom makers in-house. But I think, you know, unless you're doing a pretty small amount, you need a bigger workforce than you can put into a Mayfair shop. But then generally speaking, an external bottom maker will do the point where you block the insole, pull the upper over, put the lining, toe puff, stiffener, all that in, and stitch the welt, and then you send it back to the firm. They'll do a fitting, they'll make the adjustments that are necessary, and then it gets sent back to you for finishing, where you stick the sole on, stitch it on, build the hilt.
Done.
Yeah.
When the closed upper and lash shows up to you, they're just like, go. I mean, obviously, there might be some specs that the customer has dictated, but like, do you just set to work? Do you have conversations with anybody kind of back at home base, or are you just expected to do a beautiful job?
Like, it depends on the firm. Some firms have a bit of a notion that, you know, once they've laid down the ground rules for how they want their shoes to look. And when you say that, you know, like, we're working on the premise that everybody knows how to make a shoe pretty decently. So really, when you're talking about how somebody wants their shoes to look as a company, like a house style, the signature, you're really kind of like talking more about like shape more than anything, to be perfectly honest. That means how you interpret that last to give you kind of like the external perimeter shape of sort of mainly the four parts of the sole, and also like how they want them finished. Some people want the heels to be like dead square, and other people want their heels to be slightly pitched. But also sometimes it's more like you have regular conversation. You know, one of the firms I work for, they now have a pretty young workforce, and it's pretty rare I have to pick up the phone. It's usually like endless messages, sending each other pictures, stuff like that, where you can kind of like specify. And sometimes there are like weird things. It's like, hey, this person needs extra support. Can you make a long to inside stiffener? Can you make it really light on the outside, really firm on the inside? Those sorts of weird things.
Okay. And then you finish it up, run it back over, wait for the next one.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, if there's more than five pairs of shoes, you know, and it's too much to put in a rucksack, then I'm like, post it to me. But even if that happens, I'll probably bits and pieces take them back and you have a conversation. You don't always have the same workshop manager. And so the way that you deal with the workshop manager, how they interpret things, how they want to explain things and stuff like that, you kind of like have to feel out a little bit.
It's nice to talk to people too, right?
It is, yes. This can be like a fairly solitary experience. So having that interaction is pretty useful, actually.
So how much of this is like the same as it was 150 years ago? And how much of it is, you know, as modernized as handmade shoemaking can be? Just even from a process perspective or whatever it might be.
I wouldn't call myself a great historian on this stuff, but I would struggle off the top of my head to think what's changed about that process other than how I got in and out of the West Ends to drop off and pick up work. I'm not going by horse and carriage these days. But I think otherwise, like, yeah, I mean, if we consider the like the great sort of like a demarcation point of like a shift being the Industrial Revolution and the introduction of motorized sewing machines, yeah, I can't really think of anything that's that different, actually.
I like that. All right, look, I need a break and maybe a pint. So let's do that, and we'll come back and, yeah, we'll talk about like all the rest of the stuff that you're making. Everyone's feet are different. And oh, they are. Why does basically nobody sell great boots, loafers, and more in various widths? It's criminal. Well, the people over at Grant Stone, where nobody is a criminal, they're all actually extremely nice and law-abiding, continue to take a different path. Grant Stone currently offers over 50 styles in triple E width, with even more available in single E, and of course well over 100 styles in D width.
Looking for, say, a bourbon suede or natural chrome XL penny loafer in Triple E? Or maybe some Kudu mock toe brass boots? How about a classic diesel lace-up boot in veg tan or bison leather Triple E? I'll give you one guess on where to go. Grant Stone, if that wasn't totally clear. Best of all, everything that's in stock is in stock, which means your feet will be wildly happy in like 3 days in most cases. Not bad, Grant Stone. Not bad at all. Give Grant Stone's full lineup, including all those Triple E's, a look at GrantStoneShoes.com. And now, back to the ShoeCast.
All right, we're back with Sebastian. All right, we talked about shoes that you make for everybody else. I guess we can talk about the shoes that you make for yourself, but like that you make wholly, design, create, construct everything for clients and then for ready-to-wear stuff too. Let's get into that. Like your style of shoemaking, I mean, it's very distinctive, right? Like I think within the West End outwork in that framework, there is something very specific, right? There's a house style. Like these are very, very classic, refined, bespoke shoes, like pretty much exactly what somebody might picture for the most part, I imagine. And then there's your stuff, which is, I don't know. Like, I mean, I want to hear you describe it, but like my bad words are, it's like, it's kind of raw. It's kind of trapped in time almost. Probably like highly advanced techniques creating something that looks less finished, but maybe more work's going into it. Like, I don't know. Dissect it for me because I'm doing a terrible job of it. But like, tell me about what you see in the shoes that you want to make yourself.
In order to make shoes that look the way that my shoes do, I had to learn how to make shoes properly. And it's not that kind of like principle that you've got to learn the rules before you can break the rules. I do have a sense of aesthetic, which purposefully focus, it's kind of like it centers craft in it in a lot of ways. I want you to be able to see that they're handmade shoes. Like, I don't want the act of shoemaking being the attempt to replicate and perfect something that a machine can do. That's not the point for me. I make handmade shoes. They are very, very, very handmade shoes. In order to do that and not have them be the art of bad shoemaking, I had to learn how to make shoes really, really seriously. So one of the reasons why I've never had any interest in giving up the West End work that I do is between the two of them, I get to constantly be challenged from a craft point of view by the West End work. And then that folds into my own work where maybe the kind of like trying to refine the finish is not the final point, but like the refinement of technique continues to develop. I suppose if I think about like what my house style is that like I'm making West End bespoke shoes, but that don't look kind of like overly fussy, that aren't necessarily the kind of thing that you have to wear a suit with. The initial starting point for me when I was sort of like trying to think about like what is my aesthetic was a love of denim. Like that notion that you have a pair of jeans that like when you first get them, they go in the freezer for the first like God knows how many, you know, months because you just want them to look like they're clean. You don't want them to kind of like get these wear marks, but that slowly over time, they get these inevitable marks, which make them more beautiful or make them beautiful in a different way. So it was a combination of sort of like this idea that, you know, things have to evolve and they have to take on the signs of age and there's nothing to be afraid of that. But also like around the same sort of time, I did this big trip across Japan. And I had this crazy walk up the side of a mountain on an island called Shikoku and ended up in this like 400-year-old farmhouse staring out at this kind of like mountainside of trees that were all one kind of tree. And it's like I got to stop and think about like the beauty of singularity. And this is hugely pretentious, so I apologize in advance. I also really got into like this microtonal drone artist who actually died this week, Phil Niblock, who made music which focused on like one note. And it's just like, how do you take a single idea and allow it enough time to turn into something really multifaceted? You know, I focus a lot on material. I make pretty minimal looking shoes. I try and, you know, make shoes which, roughly speaking, always are a very classical kind of thing. But I try and allow enough space in them. So like I'm not a big fan of toe caps, a lot of big vamps, hole cuts, stuff like that, so that you have enough space space to see all of the beauty of the leather. And as a result, I've worked a lot, like for a long time, I kind of almost only work with veg tan leather. Also, one of the things is like, I had this sort of like internal parameter about like how I'm working, which was always this idea of, you know, like what a shoemaker was. And a shoemaker was somebody that took orders from people and made shoes. And as a result, I kind of only work with UK producers of material. That in itself kind of like means I got to find the most interesting UK-made leather that worked with the aesthetic. But again, that sort of like singularity of like what you can do means you've got to push things to sort of kind of like get something which is an interesting outcome.
The repeated use of singularity, that's how most people talk all the time. No, I love it. I mean, normally with these things are expensive, right? And they're fancy and you're going to source the finest calf available, like this beautiful box calf, and it's never going to crease. And meanwhile, yeah, you're using like kangaroo and kudu and, you know, these undyed leathers and baker's stuff, which is wonderful, like one of the coolest leathers that you could possibly use on a pair of footwear, but isn't necessarily refined in the same way as like a French calf or whatever. I mean, there was this old pair that I saw scrolling way back on your Instagram, I think, and it was like Fender Amp tweed, like the material from a Fender Amp on like kind of a Spectator. Yeah. And like it was absolutely sweet. Like it's totally different just from a material standpoint before you get into kind of some of these other technical moves that you put on them and lash shapes and all of it. I love it, man. It all like really speaks to me personally as somebody who like, I mean, when it's time to get dressed up, I kind of like getting dressed up, but I'm not itching to get dressed up, but I need to wear just kind of the dopest shoes that I have available to me. I guess there's other people out there because they're ordering shoes from you.
One of the reasons I love my trunk shows to Japan is in Japan, my client base is probably the most acutely not classically bespoke shoe client that you could get. But even my client base over here in London, if I'm honest, I'm probably actually starting to move slightly into like, I don't want to say a toned down, but like a slightly more grown up kind of like version of what I've done before. But for a long time, I don't think I'd have had a single client who worked in finance or banking or anything like that. All of my clients worked in kind of creative pursuits. They were looking for something that they might wear with a suit. They might not wear it with a suit, but it had to have that kind of like, I need to be dressed up, but I need to not look like my dad. I mean, also, I think one of the biggest things about like the way that I work is that the way that I work allows me to work with nice people. Working with nice people and that interaction gets so paramount to making shoes the way that I make shoes. You know, like I might make the same pair of shoes for five different people and they'll look markedly different because of that person, the conversation we had about what they want. I mean, like usually my second question will be sort of like, what do you want these for? If you're not sure about the specifics about what you want to order, then let's talk about what you want them for, because actually that's really exciting for me to know that you have either a purpose or an outfit or an event or something that you want a new pair of shoes for. And then you let me interpret that in conjunction with like how you might describe that you dress as sort of like, you know, what's the starting point?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that must be a very different experience, but also one that's like kind of necessarily more unpredictable. Like you go into the West End shop, you're like, here's the Oxford. This is the leather. We're talking about this kind of welt. Maybe we're making like some sort of custom broguing pattern, right? Like obviously there's ways to customize these shoes, but there's like a menu almost. Whereas unless somebody's seen something that you've made before and they're like, I want that one, I kind of get the feeling that you're like, I can give you something like that, but maybe not exactly. It's just very different, right? Like there's almost a significant barrier to saying, I can tell you exactly what I'm going to make for you. And so instead, you're kind of interpreting them as a person. Hopefully all those pieces fit together and they're really happy with it. And it's like, most of them are like shoes that I've never seen anybody necessarily really make before, you know? Is the process slightly different for the customer? Like, is there not as much insight, I guess, is my question.
I mean, it depends on the customer. You know, there'll be people that turn up and go, I have a very specific idea of what I want. I suppose there's like an initial vetting process. Somebody gets in touch, is like, hey, I'm thinking about getting my first pair of brogues. I'm like, cool. Do you want me to recommend somewhere you can go for that? They're like, well, you're not going to do it? But not really, no. I mean, like, I make enough rogues for the West End. And fuck knows there's enough really good shoemakers who are making beautiful brogue shoes. They don't need another guy doing it. Yeah, so, like, for the most part, like, if somebody comes to me and they want something really specific, they want something very specifically that they know that I'm the only person that's going to do it kind of thing. They're into what I do. I think then, to be honest, most people, if they're into what I do, there's already a certain amount of, like, faith that I'm going to do something that they're happy with, which is really helpful. And then you just get into the, like, you might spend an hour and a half chatting to someone. And then so a big part of that becomes, like, trust. I am an outfitter, part of a gentleman's wardrobe in just a very modern way, in a sort of sense, but at the same time in a very old-fashioned way. So what you're trying to do is to gain enough trust from somebody that they are prepared to go on the journey with. And with bespoke shoes, there's fittings. So if somebody, you know, like, tries something on and goes, like, you know what, that shape, it's just, it looks a bit too refined from, like, you know, what I'm trying to do as a general vibe, you're like, cool, well, let's just play with it a little bit. You know, it's a little fitting. If I have to make another toe puff, if I have to recut the insole, that's no big drama. You know, you're paying a lot of money for it. Like, I'm prepared to kind of go through those stages. Ultimately, it's just like a hand-holding experience to make sure that by the end of it, you're happy, I'm happy, we can hug, and you know, you wear the pair of shoes out of the shop and you love them, kind of thing.
I think that makes a ton of sense. Is it harder to find customers for this type of shoe where it's maybe a little more nebulous, but also people are like, if I'm paying $5,000 for a pair of shoes, they better be the fanciest shoes that you've ever seen in your life and absolute perfection. Like, it's a very different tack, but obviously the work is either the same or possibly more complicated because it's less templated, you know, and more time consuming for you. But in the end, it's not this just pinnacle of dress shoe perfection. Does that make it trickier from a customer perspective?
Absolutely. Yep. I think one of the other things is, like, for a long time, I tried to make my pricing as stupidly democratic as possible because I wanted to try and open it up so people who maybe weren't your classic bespoke shoe customers could afford it. But that really, really compromised my ability to do the best job possible, to be honest. So it's also like, now it's a punchy price tag, you know? It's like, not everybody who's into the vibe can afford it. And that bums me out, but it's unfortunately the reality of the situation of how much it costs to make shoes these days. When I make a pair of shoes, a brand new pair of shoes for the first fitting, it's a full working week's, you know, activity. I come in on a Monday having, you know, measured somebody's feet and I make a pair of lasts. And then Tuesday I make the patterns and I click and I prep. Wednesdays I close the upper. Thursday I got to get them over the last. And then Friday I shape up the toe puff and stitch the well. So like 5 days work. And then there's material costs. It's hard to kind of keep that kind of thing down. And that's one of the reasons for doing things which aren't necessarily bespoke. Sometimes actually the way that you get to fulfill that is something which is not bespoke. It's a slightly cheaper price point kind of thing. So as long as I've been going to Japan, I've had a non-bespoke option when I go there in the summer months. I do these wax canvas moccasins. Traditionally, like West End bespoke shoemakers will probably do bespoke shoes and slippers. They'll do a monogram velvet slipper. They'll do some sort of house shoe. This is sort of my version of that. Like, I now do a version which has got a slightly heavier sole. But one of the reasons for doing this is to kind of give people who are kind of like into the whole story a little bit, like an intro, like a first option kind of thing. And the very first time I did non-bespoke stuff under my own name was when I was working for, there was a bespoke department in the basement of this like achingly cool, like everything's dark and designer store nearby my old studio. It was called Hostum at the time. It's now called Blue Mountain School. They asked me to do something non-bespoke to go on the floor above when people actually walk in to help drag them down. So, you know, sometimes you just got to do something which is a little bit more accessible.
Yeah. And so what, I mean, I've seen some of that, let's call it ready to wear, I guess. And what would you do? You'd work with them, figure out something, and then make like a dozen pairs or something like that? Like, how did it work?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I'm not a shoe designer. I never studied shoe design. I mean, I might have worked on a shoe design course for a very long time, but I can't draw to save my life. Like, I literally can't. So I treated the store as the customer. And it's a bit like, how do you interpret this place and the buyers and, you know, the creative director of the store as a single item? We started with the last and then like, okay, cool. How do we flesh this out into sort of like more than one style? That was the first time I worked with what was called Clayton's at the time, their quarter van shell. And, you know, I think this must have been more than 10 years ago. At the time, I think Clayton's was maybe one of two or three tanneries in the world that was making quarter van. And to be frank, they didn't do it that well. It was a bit shiny. Like, you know, everything you love about Halloween quarter van, they hadn't quite got there. But because, you know, at the tannery, you know, 2 hours on a train away, I could go and see them and talked about what were the things that they weren't quite happy about with the process and how to cut them out. And so I ended up getting this like amazing semi-finished quarter van. So it's almost like a quarter van that's not glossy. Well, it's not glossy. You know, they kind of like cut out the last two protesters of the finishing stage to give me this like really dusty effect quarter van. And so I used that. So it's like, cool. Okay. Well, I've got one idea. I found this cool tannery. Do you like it? Right. Like, let's go from there. And it just spun out from that.
That's cool. And so you're still doing that kind of stuff?
Not so much. I mean, like, for starters, I gave myself a really serious repetitive strain injury in my wrist trying to knock out 15 pairs of Norwegian welted boots. Yeah, it's brutal. I'm not very good with the attention span of doing the same thing five times in a row. Like, a brand new project can be kind of cool in that way. But, like, actually, I think the truth is for doing something which is not bespoke, it needs to go to people who make non-bespoke shoes. So I'm at the very, very, very beginning stages of the development of a proper ready-to-wear manufactured shoe in Japan.
All right.
My last trip out there, my stockers took me to this incredible tiny atelier in Asakusa, which is where all the shoemaking happens. We talked about how we could work together. So I'm going to be making something in Japan, manufactured, using as many UK materials as are available in Japan, of which is actually a lot. Trying to make something which is not quite so angular, if you like, something which is just a little bit more relaxed and just a little bit more accessible, you know?
Nice and blobby. All right, man. Keep me updated on that. The Japanese kind of tell me what to like with my shoes. It works every time.
That's an incredible industry. I'm so fortunate that I get to go out to Japan as regularly as I do, because there's what you think of as shoemaking, and then it's Japan, which is where that shit is still, like, the standards, the dedication, the passion for it, but also like the accessibility of being able to be based in a major metropolis, which is one of the major cities for the purchasing of bespoke shoes, which is actually kind of affordable to live in, means that there's just this huge gamut of shoemakers making incredible things without having to stress quite as much as being somewhere like New York or London, kind of, you know, about like how you're going to find the way to live.
Yeah, it's got a lot of the right ingredients. What else? What else is on the horizon? You know, especially with things that are maybe, you know, kind of accessible to people, or how are you accessible to people if they're interested in your work?
For nuts and bolts, kind of like, you know, you want to come and get a pair of shoes made, all the usual channels, email, social, that kind of stuff. I moved into a new studio after 16 years in my old space. So I'm now just opposite Spitalfields Market in East London. So seeing people here, which is nice. I'm heading out to Japan either late February or early March by the looks of things, which will be sort of like the next step of the development of this ready-to-wear line, which I think we're hoping to have ready either at the end of this year or the beginning of next. I think I'm going to put my big boy pants on and finally start coming out to the States.
Come in October.
Well, it sounds nice. I set up this made-to-order boot thing at the very beginning of COVID with my Japanese stockers. And now I'm going back out there, but we don't really need to do that. So I might kind of like take that back, maybe bring that out to you guys. I'm kind of at the moment sort of like shopping around for an outlet to work with over there. You know, like traditionally trunk shows, which are the visits from a UK shoemaker to Your Fair Shores involves taking a hotel room, putting your stuff out there and seeing people for a couple of days. But I've tended to work with stockists, with shops, because I like it more. You know, that means that there's a store that has an existing client base. You know who you're going to be dealing with a little bit, you know, because like the store will have like their kind of like MO that's kind of like what makes them unique. And it also just means that you're probably dealing with people who've been there before. So I'm kind of searching out a little bit at the moment for where might be the right outlet for that. And sort of like in terms of sort of like broader shoemaking stuff, we've got the Supertrunk in May with the next iteration of the shoemaking competition, which I think is going to be a loafer this time. So that'll be interesting.
Oh, nice. I didn't know that.
The brief went out. Shit, I hope the brief went out. Yeah, I think the brief's gone out to the public. Yeah. I think I have to look for it on the shoegazing website to understand what the hell it is that I'm supposed to be judging. and before that, at the end of February, I'm going to the annual UK Independent Shoemakers Conference, which is this really wonderful kind of like lovely, cuddly kind of event that takes place somewhere in the UK, broadly speaking, every year. You know, it's a group of anywhere between like 30 and 100 independent shoemakers who get together for a one-day event, which is preceded by an almighty piss-up in the bar the night before.
The night before? Why?
Yeah, I know. Like, I've never quite understood the timing of that. So you get blind drunk, stagger to your hotel room, and then 4 hours wake up and realize you have to deliver a presentation to your peers and colleagues. But that's an amazing event. So if there's any kind of like, you know, aspiring or interested shoemakers who are in the UK or thinking about coming to the UK, I mean, actually, to be honest, that one is fully booked already. But that's a wonderful event that takes place every year. And it really is, you know, this kind of like focal point for people who are just really passionate about making shoes. It'll be like a day of presentations, workshops, and it's open to anyone. So yeah, if you're interested in that, Google it. There's a website and you can find out all information about that.
Yeah, man, I've heard wonderful things. As a non-shoemaker, you know, they keep rejecting my application.
If you want to come, you can come. Anyway, like you just say you're an enthusiastic vocationalist.
I like a beer. Can I come? All right, man. Shit, I don't know. Wait, and you're still doing the outwork too amidst all this?
Yeah. Like the outwork, kind of like it ebbs and flows a little bit. At the moment, I'm doing quite a lot of it. There maybe comes a time. I mean, look, you'd be mad to rely on one thing straight.
Gotta diversify.
Exactly. Unless you've got a really thriving business, it's useful to have more than one egg in a basket. So with the outwork, I'm still doing it. It's just for one company these days, but they're a big company, so there's always a lot of work. This is the first year I stopped teaching in quite a while. I was working at a local college up in North London that was offering the UK's only foundation level shoemaking course. Who knows, I might kind of like dip back in there at some point. The UK education industry, like, is at a kind of funny place. There's a lot of courses, but most of them really focus on design. So this is a really nice opportunity just to kind of like take it back to like you're learning how to make shoes. Yeah, I'm always interested in sort of like a way to stay connected to the education industry and finding pathways for people who want to become shoemakers to do so, because it's not easy. It doesn't exist in the way that it used to. And, you know, there's a bit of a struggle that exists to try and keep that in like a fairly accessible way for all.
Oh, but you quit, so.
Look, it's really, really hard to try and do Japanese trunk shows when you're working 2 days a week every week. The first trip I did back to Tokyo, I didn't tell the students. I left school on a Wednesday. I stayed in an airport hotel. On Thursday morning, I flew out. I landed Friday morning. I traded Saturday, Sunday. I got on a plane on the Monday morning, arrived back in the UK Monday night, and I was at school on Tuesday morning. And to be fair, that was not exactly a kind thing to do to the students. I was a little bit of a shadow of my professional best self.
All right, man. Look, a lot of eggs, a lot of baskets. Keep filling them up. We got to call this somewhere. Huge thanks to Grant Stone for sponsoring the episode. Support the ShoeCast by checking out that Stitchdown premium membership in the Discord. And save the dates, October 12th and 13th, 2024, for Stitchdown's Bootcamp 2 in Industry City, Brooklyn. Can't wait to see you, maybe Sebastian, on both the internet and the non-internet. But most of all, man, thanks so much for coming on. I love this. This is great.
Thank you very much, man. It was really, really lovely. Thank you.
That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.